Hey everybody, we're live. Happy almost July 4th.
Mm-hmm. It's a source of endless amusement to me that Britain is doing their big elections as we record this tomorrow on the 4th of July. And I find that funny because, you know, July 4th is our Independence Day. And I was talking to Mike about this, and he, in a very gentle and kind way, basically said, "We don't care. We don't think about you at all." But, you know, what are you going to do? But it does make me laugh nevertheless. And it sounds like their election is going to be a lot better than ours. So there's that. Unrelated to that, however,
very hard not to think about what's going to happen to our country in a few months. Like, we're just going to enjoy this summer and not, oh God. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, I think we are closer to a monarchy, thanks to the Supreme Court, than Britain is. But here we are. I have to say, I went to lunch. So there's a handful of people that I'll schedule like a monthly FaceTime call with. And most of them, you know, almost all of them are, in fact, all of them are not local. And then there's a handful of people that I try to do lunch with like once a month. And my good friend Sam, he and I had our monthly lunch today, and we went to a place sort of kind of downtown Richmond. And it's a chain, the small chain, I think it's Jack Brown's Burger or something or other, or whatever. And so I had a cheeseburger, which was very good. And we sat outside because the weather wasn't too sticky quite yet at the time we ate lunch. But I had a problem. During lunch, there was music outside, which was good. But the Jack Brown Burger joint trolled me because they were playing a Phish album during the entire lunch. And all I could do was think about how happy you would be if you were there, or if you at least knew this was happening as it was happening. In retrospect, I should have like FaceTimed you or something just to be like, listen to this junk. And the worst part of all, you could tell me what songs I heard and I would probably be like, sure. But there were a couple of songs that even I recognized as Phish songs. Like, you know, not only did it have the vibe of Phish, but I like had heard the songs before and recognized them. And I forget which ones they were. The only one I know by name is Bouncing Around the Room, and that was not it. But there was one, and I'm sure this is describing half a Phish catalog, but where it was repeating the same phrase over and over again. And it was very catchy.
That's fairly common.
Yeah, exactly. But anyways.
David Bowie, maybe?
I'm kind of proud of you that you recognized that it was Phish, because I'm not sure I could do that. I don't know any of their songs. Maybe I could pick it up based on vibe, but I don't think I've even heard that much. So, like, you must... When are you listening to Phish so much that
I can give you a good heuristic, John. If you hear a song that you don't recognize, you don't think you've ever heard it on the radio before, look around the room, and if...
Bounce around the room, even.
And if the whitest guy in the room is slightly bopping his head to it.
That's me, though.
And zero other people are. There's a decent chance it's Phish.
Mm, it could be anything. Gosh. Like, I don't know. I think my chances of spontaneously recognizing, like, you're at a restaurant, there's music playing in the background, spontaneously recognizing Phish, I think my odds are very low. I guess I'd have to look for somebody with the little red blood cell pattern on their clothing, and if they were bop into it or something, then I could figure it out.
Right.
Now I know what that is. That's the one thing I can recognize. Marco taught me what that is, and now I see it on people's like license plate surrounds. I'm like, oh, one of them.
Anyway, the worst part of the entire lunch, and about the only bad part of this lunch, because I really do enjoy Sam so very much. Yes.
Did you like some of it?
It wasn't bad. It really wasn't bad. The thing of it is, I've said this publicly and I've said this many times privately, like for the purposes of the lulls, you know, I'll exaggerate my hatred of Phish, and truly, like, I don't seek them out. That is true. But they're really not bad. I give you a hard time because I can. But it was reasonably enjoyable. And now I thought to myself at the time, oh, I'll remember this lyric that they're repeating over and over, knowing full well that that is half of their catalog. And you would think I would know myself better. Yeah, because my memory is so very reliable. You would think I would know myself well enough by now, but I don't. So I can't tell you what it was. But whatever I was listening to, it was actually fairly enjoyable. I feel like, I'm probably wrong, but I feel like they were just playing like a released live. Well, see, I can't say a released live album because damn, Phish releases everything, and I'm
so
jealous.
But they that would actually narrow it down, because while Phish does release all their shows like on their on the Live Phish download site, they don't release all their shows to like Spotify and Apple Music. Like the
right,
the music,
exactly.
Like, the music streaming services only have a relatively small number of Live Phish albums usually.
Yeah, and maybe if I'm feeling particularly energetic tomorrow, well, no, I'm going to be doing 4th of July stuff. Next time I'm, you know, at my desk working, maybe I'll play, you know, one or two of the live albums and see if I can come up with the name of the song just so you can have a chuckle about it. But, and maybe, I don't know, what did you say a minute ago, David Bowie or something like that? It very well could have been it.
You
I
would
no
know.
Idea, but.
If you look up the lyrics to David Bowie by Phish, it could have maybe been Waiting in the Velvet Sea. That's I love that one, but yeah, it doesn't matter. We'll figure it out.
Exactly.
Identifying Phish songs by its lyrics. That's probably
That's slightly more effective, I reckon, than Dave Matthews' lyrics, which are truly terrible. And I think part of the reason that I enjoy Dave Matthews so much is because I really do not care about lyrics in pretty much anything I listen to. It's just not the way I listen to music. but the Dave Matthews Band lyrics are something. Nevertheless, I was thinking of you even while I was having a very lovely lunch with my friend Sam.
And hearing some decent music.
It was annoyingly decent. Anyway, speaking of music, which I'm not sure if it was better or worse, and I'm not looking for input on this gentleman, but Brian Hamilton wrote
no,
to
no,
us.
No,
oh, I forgot. I forgot. Yes, damn it. That was such a good segue.
I heard you making the segue. I'm like, oh, you made the segue. He's going to go right into it. But then you skipped. Then you skipped.
I had such a good segue, too.
You need now skip protection.
I know. We do need skip protect. God, we're so old. All right. Let me just I'll abort all of that. Hello, bootleg people, and goodbye, bootleg people.
Bye.
So we have a new member special. We have gone back to the well, and we have done another ATP tier list. John, can you remind us all, what is a tier list?
I can't remind you all, because everybody knows what a tier list, except for old people who listen to this podcast, but then they've also heard the specials before. So it's a tier list. You rank things. You put them in tiers. Multiple things can be in a single tier. The top tier is S. Why? Nobody knows, except somebody knows, but we don't really care. The point is, it's better than A. It's a tier list.
So we did a tier list.
And it's grading. It's like A through F, and then S on top of A.
Mm-hmm. And we graded all the iPods, or at least most of them anyhow. And so I am pretty confident that we did a pretty good job on this. There was a little bit of horse trading involved, but I'm pretty happy with where we ended up. We made a handful of people that we know very upset, and I'm sorry that you're upset, but we're right. So if you are curious to hear this tier list or any of the others, you can go to atp.fm/join. And if you join even for but a month, but you should do more, then you can get to all of the members specials. We've been trying to do one a month for what, like a year or two now? I forget exactly how long it's been, but we've racked up a fair number over the course of the last several months. There's a handful of tier lists. We do ATP Eats, among other things. There's a lot of good stuff in there and some silly stuff. So ATP tier list. And if you are a member and you would like to watch the tier list happen, which is not required, but is occasionally helpful, there is a super secret YouTube link in the show notes for members where you can go and watch it on YouTube as well. Please do not share that. It's the honor system, but you can check it out there as well.
It's in the show notes for the member special. That is.
Sorry, yes, thank you.
When you go to the iPod tier list member special, look in the show notes. The first link will be the YouTube video. I like this tier list because they reveal something about the things that we are ranking, something that we, at least I usually didn't know going in. You think, oh, you're just going to rank them and people are going to, you know, have controversies over which is good and which is bad. But I think in the end, when you look at the whole tier list and you kind of look at the shape of it and how it's worked out and how contentious the choices would be, you learn something about it. Like, I think our connectors tier list was like that. And I think the iPod one turned out like that too. And the reason we made some people angry is because we know a lot of really weird tech people with very specific and often very strange opinions, specifically about iPods.
I think so, you could also say incorrect opinions.
Like, they have their reasons. At least most of them have reasons that make some sense. I think one of the things we learned, not to spoil too much, is that a lot of people have, you know, all the things that we put in tier lists, people can have personal sentimental reasons for. We all certainly do. And, you know, the listeners do as well. And I think iPods, more than anything we've done before, like the people who had opinions, they swayed heavily into the sentimental, right? It was, you know, it was like, this was my first iPod. This, I really love this thing, right? Much more so than the past tier list we've done. So I think, you know, maybe the iPod at that point was the most personal product Apple had ever made.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, I had a lot of fun with this one because, like, even though, like, I hardly ever really used iPods, because by the time I could really afford decent iPods, it was only very shortly before the iPhone really took over. So I only really had a couple of years with iPods, but those couple of years, I really liked the iPods, and this was actually fun. So, and if, just for, you know, coincidence sake, I happened to have bought a couple of iPod Nanos off of eBay a couple of years back, just to kind of play around with, and I took them out the other night after we recorded this episode and charged them up. Well, the ones that we'll accept to charge at least, charged them up and got to play around with the old iPod Nano. And I will just say, I stand by everything I said on that episode. Everything.
Yeah.
So feel free to listen and tell us how wrong we are. And you can, you too, listener, can pay us $8 a month to yell at your podcast player just a little bit more. So we encourage you to do that.
That's absolutely great marketing. Thank you, Marco.
And by the way, our membership episodes are DRM free. And so if you happen to use an iPod to listen to your podcasts, we are fully compatible. So you can pay us $8 a month to listen to our member content on an iPod if you actually have one. And you can honestly buy one on eBay for only a few months worth of membership fee, because they're pretty cheap these days.
Indeed. And hey, what would you listen to on an iPod if not a podcast? Well, you could listen to music, and you could listen to music on a U2 iPod. And so Brian Hamilton wrote in with regard to the red and black colored U2 iPod. We were wondering on the episode, or certainly there was some mumblings about it on Mastodon afterwards, you know, how did they get to red and black for the color scheme of the U2 iPod? And Brian wrote in to remind John and us about how to dismantle an atomic bomb, which was released November 22 of 2004. And the color scheme on the cover art for that album is red and black. Where were you on that one, John, Mr. U2?
Yeah, I remember it once I was reminded of it. I mean, here's the thing. Like I said on the episode, it's not as if red and black became like the iconic colors of the band. This was one album that was released, obviously at the same time as the iPod, as part of a promotional thing. Like the first U2 iPod was released in like October, and the album came out in November. So it's a tie-in, right? And then there were future U2 iPods, and they were also red and black, but at that point U2 hadn't released a new album. So they're all just tied to this one album. But they have released a lot of albums, and there were future albums, and there were past albums, and I can tell you that this one and this color scheme did not become heavily associated with the band. But that's the reason. That's why they went with red and black, because of the cover of the album.
Are you saying that an assumption? I'm genuinely asking. Are you saying
once I was reminded, I'm like, oh yeah, that's why they did it. I mean, it's not a great reason, but I'm pretty sure it's the reason.
Yeah, fair enough. Max Velasco Knott writes in that there's also another feature, and I'm using air quotes here, on the U2 iPod. Max writes, the U2 iPods featured signatures of the band members on the backside. I was fine with the black-red color scheme, but couldn't stand seeing Bono and company on the back whenever I turned them over.
Yeah, that's, I had forgotten about that as well. That, I mean, obviously it's a shiny back and it doesn't show up that much, but if you really just wanted a red and black iPod and didn't care about the band, the signatures on the back kind of messed it up a little.
Indeed. Nikolai Bronvall Ernst writes to us with regard to the DMA and Apple's cut. Nikolai writes, I really enjoyed your last show, 593, not a European lawyer. I'm also not a European lawyer, but I am a citizen in the EU and wanted to provide a single European's point of view. The DMA has nothing to do with Apple's cut in the App Store or how much money Apple earns from selling their hardware. It only has to do with ensuring fair competition, citizens' rights to freely choose services they want to use without vendor lock-ins on interoperability, portability, and your own data, which we here in the EU believe belongs to the user. That's a pretty good summary.
A lot of people have written in to say this, but I think people will get hung up with the idea when we talk about like Apple's cut and how the EU is trying to control that. And they're like, the EU is not trying to tell Apple how much money it can make. It's just trying to do this other thing. But the reason it gets mixed up and the reason people send us these emails is because what Apple did to, supposedly comply with the DMA while also trying to prevent competition is an application of fees. So that we, the EU says you have to allow for competition. Apple says, okay, sure, we'll allow competition, but all of our competitors have to pay us an amount that makes it so they can't compete with us, right? And the cut we're talking about is not Apple's cut from its own App Store. Like when you sell through the App Store, you pay Apple some cut. It's the cut Apple demands from the app stores and the people selling through app stores that are not Apple's own app store, that are selling through third-party app stores. Apple is using money, using fees to make the competition less competitive. And that's what we're talking about. And I know it's, you can get confusing when we're talking about Apple collecting its money or Apple having its fees and stuff like that. So I think maybe that's the source of the confusion. And the other thing is, by the way, that plenty of countries, including the EU, do actually tell companies that they can't make a certain amount of money on a certain thing that they do. Someone wrote in to give us the example of like credit cards, like a MasterCard and Visa, the two big credit card networks. I think in the EU, the fees they charge stores to process their credit cards are essentially capped. And the EU has basically said, you know, Visa and MasterCard own the market. You can continue to do that, but you can't charge merchants any more than point whatever percent. The EU has not done that to Apple. Apple, they haven't said to Apple, hey, Apple, you can't charge more than 10% in your own app store. They haven't said that at all. They haven't said anything about what Apple can charge in their app store. What they just want is more competition, and Apple is saying, okay, there can be other app stores, but they all have to give us an amount of money that makes it unattractive. And yeah, we'll see how that flies. Again, the EU has not yet ruled on the core technology fee and all the other things that they're investigating. So far, they've only ruled on the steering provisions about how Apple restricts the way apps in its own app store can link out to third-party payment methods. But we'll see how those other decisions come out in the coming months and years. I don't know how long this is going to take, but right now it's not looking good for the core technology fee. Let's say that.
Yep. We asked for, mostly tongue-in-cheek, but we asked for Brexit-style names for Apple leaving the EU. Jared Counts was the first we saw to suggest I Leave. Frederick Bjormann suggested Axit and provided a truly heinous but hilarious, I presume AI-generated image for this. My personal favorite, though, was suggested several times. First we saw was from Oliver Thomas, I Quit.
Yeah,
the I Leave and I Quit. We had many more suggestions. These, I thought these were the top three. The I Leave and I Quit are cute, but I kind of like Axit because it's as close to Brexit and the axe thing. Like the picture has like an EU themed Superman holding an axe and an apple. And yes, it does look AI generated. It's interesting how due to the way the various AI models that we're familiar with have been trained, most people can now look at an image and identify it immediately as AI generated based on like the shading and the weirdness of hands and all sorts of other stuff. It is kind of strange how quickly that happened. But anyway, I kind of like Axit, but I don't think we get to pick this name. So, I mean, MacBook One didn't really catch on. Neither did
MacBook. Oh, please. It sure did.
Well, within our little circle of podcasts, yes. But I don't see the New York Times running with Axit or I Quit.
Yeah, we don't really seem to have naming power in the greater ecosystem.
If we try hard enough, we can make Fetch happen. All right. Someone anonymously wrote in with regard to CarPlay Audio. We were wondering how CarPlay Audio worked, especially with the new CarPlay, and whether or not it was more like AirPlay 2, where it like sends a big buffer or whatnot. And so Anonymous writes, audio and wireless CarPlay is always over Wi-Fi. Buffered audio for CarPlay is basically AirPlay 2. Buffered audio is available without doing next-gen CarPlay.
Yeah, this was news to me because I had speculated that it seemed like all CarPlay audio was always going over Bluetooth, and that maybe because it seemed like, you know, wireless CarPlay, I think, actually creates like a little ad hoc Wi-Fi network between the car and the phone, and wired CarPlay sends all that stuff over the wire. And I kind of assumed wired CarPlay, it seemed like it does audio and video over the wire. Wireless, it seemed like it was doing Wi-Fi for the audio, or for the video signal, rather, but Bluetooth for the audio. And apparently, this person wrote in who I think would know such things, and they said, nope, it's always over Wi-Fi. So that, to me, first of all, is kind of good news in the sense that, like, you can have improved responsiveness, you can have, you know, more better reliability for the audio, because it's already going over Wi-Fi, and so you can do all that with current CarPlay tech. You don't have to use the new CarPlay system. The kind of sad and frustrating part is, then why do wireless CarPlay implementations out there in the world so often have just massively long buffers that make it really laggy and annoying?
If you'll permit me to jump in here, yeah. I have been meaning to bring up, and I keep forgetting because, as previously mentioned, my memory is garbage. When we went to the beach a couple of weeks ago and found out that Aaron's car was totaled, we had to rent something to get there, much to John's dismay. And so we rented a Chrysler Pacifica minivan. I believe we talked about this on the show. Did I mention that the CarPlay, the wireless CarPlay implementation, was actually really good? And not only that, but the screen was also really good. Like, it wasn't full retina, I wouldn't say, but it was surprisingly high resolution. And my wireless CarPlay in my car, which is a little dongle that I, you know, added to basically bridge between wired and wireless, which is fine. I'll put a link in the show notes. I get asked about it all the time. It works fine. I wouldn't say it's spectacular, but it's sufficient. The implementation of the Pacifica was actually really, really good. And I presume that there was some amount of lag, but it was really not bad at all. I was very impressed by it. So I'm not trying to say you're wrong, Marco, because I have also seen some crummy wireless CarPlay implementations. But it seems like, of all people, Chrysler might have done a pretty good one. Who would have thunk it?
Yeah.
All right, Kirk Northrup points us to a New York Times article with regard to using AirPods Pro as hearing protection. This is kind of a lot to read, but I think it's worth it because this really distills down the summary, and we'll put a link in the show notes if you want to read it for yourself. Reading from the article. As you can see in the results, any claim that the AirPods Pro's adaptive transparency or hear-through mode limits sound to 85 decibels does not prove true in our testing. The earbuds did bring the 105 decibel sound down to 95 decibels, which is a big improvement over using no hearing protection at all. But that's adequate for only about 45 minutes of exposure under simulated conditions. Keep in mind that noise guidelines are designed with the assumption that a person who has no other loud noise exposure throughout the day. If you were previously exposed to loud noise levels through your work or hobbies, you would likely want to be even more careful when attending a concert in the same day. The hear-through mode in the Bose Quiet Comfort Earbuds 2, which Bose calls the Aware mode, did a little better in our tests, limiting the sound to 91 decibels, a level of volume reduction that might be adequate for a two-hour concert. As we swapped the earbuds for earplugs and switched back and forth between the earbuds hear-through and noise-canceling modes, we were surprised to hear how much more enjoyable the show was when we used the AirPods Pro earbuds as hearing protection. Using the AirPods Pro's adaptive transparency gave us, in essence, a quieter version of the unattenuated live sound. The guitars, drums, and vocals all sounded surprisingly clear, and our enjoyment of the sound wasn't lessened at all. However, as our measurements predicted, it was still too loud. After about 10 minutes of listening, our ears grew fatigued.
Yeah, this is interesting, you know. So what, you know, what the Wirecutter did was run a, you know, basically like they have like a test setup with an artificial ear, basically, that they can put these earbuds into and measure what gets sent through them. I question whether these results are universal, because again, like as somebody who's now watched, I think, four concerts maybe with AirPods Pro as my earplugs, I know what it feels like to have my ears blown out from a concert, and like how it feels during and afterwards. And when I use the AirPods Pro, it doesn't feel that way at all. It feels just like using earplugs, which is what I was doing before using the AirPods Pro. And when the Apple Watch measures the sound pressure hitting my ears, like when it indicates when you're wearing the AirPods Pro what it's doing, it caps at 85 decibels when they're being used this way. So, and I have found, for whatever it's worth, like I have like an SPL meter, because of course I do, and I have found the Apple Watch's sensitivity to be pretty accurate, although obviously it wouldn't be using the watch's built-in mic when you have AirPods Pro in. So maybe there's some other factors there.
Yeah,
but
how would it possibly be measuring the sound on the inside of your ear? Is there a microphone that's facing the inside of your ear?
I don't know for sure. I think there might be. Isn't that how they do the calibration stuff?
That's what I was going to say. Now, I don't know how accurate it is.
Yeah.
But
I always thought it was like doing the sound leaking out of the... It would play sound into the thing and then listen on the microphone that's external to see how much sound is bleeding out of the ear to say whether the fit is correct.
It's possible. Anyway, the point is, my experience actually using them, it really does not feel like I'm hearing a 95 decibel concert for 3 hours. Like that, it feels like what it says of 85. So what
well,
I'm guessing
how loud was the concert outside of the ear? Where you're from your seat, did you look at like the decibel meter of like, if I had nothing on, what would the level be?
Yes. So I did a couple of times where I would like take the AirPods out and put them away so they turn off, and just listen to and watch and see how the watch measures the concert, you know, fully. And it was, I don't remember exactly, but I remember it was somewhere in the high 90s, I think. So not quite as loud as there. So maybe the difference is that they were coming from 105 decibels,
yeah,
and they came into 95, and I was coming, I think, from somewhere in the 90s and down to 85. So maybe that's the cause, or it could just be differences in fit. You know, I don't know exactly how good is the Seal with their artificial ear setup compared to my actual ear? I don't know. There's no good way to know that. So I think the conclusion to draw here is, first of all, what we kind of already knew, which is they provide some protection, you know, suitable for occasional concert goers, not suitable if you're going to be like working in a factory every single day. Like there's, you know, different degrees of protection that you might need. If like, you know, this is not everyday protection. But also it probably varies a little bit between both fit and between, you know, what exactly you're actually listening to, like how loud is your environment? Is it, it can't bring down 105 decibels, but maybe it can bring down 95 decibels. Like, you know, there's, so obviously there are other variables here. So I think the advice that I would give remains the same, which is if you have like really serious hearing protection needs or very frequent hearing protection needs, get real hearing protection. If you are an occasional concert goer like me and you want basic hearing protection for occasional concerts, this is probably fine unless you are standing like directly next to the giant PA speaker. Maybe you might need a little bit more protection. But this seems fine to me. And every time I've used them, I feel great afterwards and my ears don't ring at all. And there's no fatigue. So like it seems to be working. So maybe it just has a limit to how much it can work.
Yep. Apple is apparently using Google Cloud infrastructure to train and serve AI. This is from HPC Wire. Apple has two new homegrown AI models, including a 3 billion parameter model for on-device AI and a larger LLM for servers with resources to allow or to answer more queries. The ML models, developed with TensorFlow, were trained on Google's TPU. John, remind me what TPU stands for.
Tensor Processing Unit, something like that. Yeah. We talked about the actual hardware on a past show and how many billions of computations or whatever they do and how many different operands are in each operation. But yeah, I think it's like a tensor processing unit or something like that. It's basically, so Google doesn't buy its GPUs from NVIDIA and put them. It makes its own silicon to do machine learning. It has for many, many years. This is not a new thing. They're called TPUs, and that's what they're currently using to train Gemini and stuff. And if you pay them, just like you pay AWS or whatever, you pay Google Cloud, I believe they will rent you their TPUs and you can train your models on it. And that's what Apple did.
Indeed. Apple's AX Learn AI framework used to train the homegrown LLMs creates Docker containers that are authenticated to run on the GCP or Google Cloud something. What is that? Google Cloud?
Computing? I don't know.
Computers?
It's GCP is like AWS. It's Amazon Web Services, but Google.
Anyway, to run on the GCP infrastructure, AX Learn supports the Bastion orchestrator, which is supported only by Google Cloud. This is a quote from their GitHub documentation. While the Bastion currently only supports Google Cloud Platform, there you go, I should have kept reading, my bad, Google Cloud Platform jobs, its design is cloud agnostic, and in theory, it can be extended to run on other cloud providers, Apple stated on its AX Learn infrastructure page on GitHub.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, we didn't put this in the notes, but the rumors are that the deal between Apple and Google to use Gemini as part of iOS 18 as an option alongside a ChatGPT, that deal is reportedly getting closer. But this is from the past of like, hey, Apple's got these models, the one that's going to be running on people's phones or the various ones that are running on their phones, which are smaller, and the big ones they're going to be running on their private cloud compute. And these are Apple's own models and they train them themselves. And how did they train them? They paid Google to use TPUs to train their models. And so I feel like this is interesting in that Apple's unfriendly relationship, let's say, with NVIDIA continues. Right, and their friendly relationship with Google continues. It's kind of a surprise that Google didn't do the deal. Maybe the rumors are, I think we talked about this on a past show, that nobody's paying anybody for the OpenAI thing, whereas maybe Google wanted to be paid. So we'll see how this works out. But there seems to be a cozy relationship between Apple and Google, because apparently Apple either doesn't have yet or doesn't plan to have fleets of massively parallel machine learning silicon that they can train their models on, but Google does.
All right, let's do some topics. And John, I hear that you have asked Apple for help and they have said, you know what you need? You need a Mac Studio. Because why would anyone need a Mac Pro?
This went around, I think, a week or two ago. Apple's got a page, apple.com/Mac/best-Mac. And the title of the page is Help Me Choose. Answer a few questions to find the best Mac for you. And when this was going around, the first thing I did was launch this page, and I wanted to go through the little wizard and answer a bunch of questions to see if I could reach the win condition, which is having this tool recommend the Mac Pro.
Is that the win condition?
It is the win condition.
Are you sure?
And the answer was very clear. And I was mostly telling the truth, but occasionally I would, you know, exaggerate to make sure I go on the Mac Pro path. And I did not end up at a Mac Pro. It recommended a Mac Studio to me, and that a bunch of other people tried. And then Julio Monter. Oh, I can't do this one. Let's see. Julio Montier. All right. You wrote this. You must have written this out.
No, I didn't. You did. Julio Montagnier.
Montagnier.
Yeah.
All right. We got to try that again.
Okay.
I don't remember where I left off.
So you were starting to say a lot of people started digging under the hood. You might just want to reboot the whole damn thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm not so good at rebooting the whole damn thing. Anyway. So a bunch of people tried to use this tool to get Mac Pro. Nobody could do it. And Julio Montier tried it and found out how to cheat to win the game. If you look at the source code, you can see that there's like a JSON file that defines the options for the endpoints. And that JSON, it's not a JSON file, but a bunch of JSON. That JSON does not contain the Mac Pro. It contains pretty much every other Mac that Apple sells. Cool. But there is no way to get to the Mac Pro, because the Mac Pro is not one of the options.
I think
that's
this is
weird.
Apple. This is Apple telling you that literally nobody wants this computer. So, nobody should have.
Just for reference, we all agree on this show that the current Mac Pro is not a great computer, but it is a computer that exists. And on top of that, there is at least one very specific reason why someone might want to use it. If one of the questions had asked, "Hey, do you have a bunch of PCI Express cards that you need to use?" If the answer to that is yes, it's literally the only computer Apple sells that you can do that on.
The people who made this quiz know what a PCI Express card is?
I mean, it's Apple. Like, they have questions and answers for every other computer. It just seems weird to me. Now, I can understand saying, well, this is not a great computer, and really, honestly, no one should really buy it. Like, I agree with all of that. But when you make a help me choose tool on your website, you should have all of the things as endpoints. And yeah, make the Mac Pro pretty much impossible to get to unless you need it. But there is, you know, there is a reason someone might need it. If someone is going through this tool and saying, I don't know what I'm going to do. I've got all these audio cards that I need to use for, you know, my old Mac is dying. Is there some other computer that I can use? How would you determine that that Apple still sells computers with card slots in them? Everyone on Mastodon was saying, okay, well, the people who need the Mac Pro know it, and so they don't need to use this tool. That's not how these tools work. You could say the same thing about, well, the people who need an iMac know they want an all-in-one thing, so they don't need to use this tool. If you already know which computer you need, yes, you don't need this tool. But the tool exists to lead you to whichever product that Apple sells is best suited for you. And it's weird to leave just one out. And I would just love to know the thinking behind that process. Because, like, look, if Apple doesn't want to sell them, don't sell them, right? But they're selling them. You can buy them for a huge amount of money. And the tool can make it difficult or almost impossible to get there, because when it says, how many PCI Express cards do you need to use? The default choice should be zero, or I don't know what a PCI Express card is. Like, have a million options that regular people will click, and they will lead them off that path and say, you shouldn't buy this. But if the person says three, or any number other than zero, you have to lead them to the Mac Pro, because it's literally the only computer they sell with card slots.
I mean, you're going to hate this, but so I did the whole quiz trying to get to the Mac Pro before you said it wasn't an option, and just putting in all like the highest requirements, like, you know, I do 3D editing and content creation and video editing and audio editing, and I need all these tools. I need to connect a bunch of stuff to my Mac, and it recommended exactly what I'm using right now. The MacBook Pro 16-inch.
At
least get a Mac Studio.
Well, no,
nope.
Because when the question it asks is, do you do all your work in a single location or do you need to be portable? Did you say, oh, I do all my work in a single location?
I said, like, on the one desk option, the very top option where it's like, I do everything at the same place, like on a desk. Like, I'd at least get a Mac Studio.
I think a lot of the endpoints recommend two computers. Like, I didn't just get the Mac Studio. I got recommended the Mac Studio and the MacBook Pro.
Oh, I also got two computers, the MacBook Pro $4,000 configuration and the MacBook Pro $3,500 configuration.
Yeah, I don't know how you didn't end up with desktop, because there must have been some question there that's differentiating portability. If, obviously, if you mention you ever need to take it somewhere, they're not going to recommend a desktop. But yeah, I don't know how great this tool is. Wizards in general are not great. I like their comparison ones, like for the phones, where it does like columns and you can list all the features and scroll and see how they are different from each other. This doesn't do that, but I do think it's very strange to not have a single one of your computers in there. Remember when they were selling the trash can for years and years, and really nobody should be buying that, right? But if you needed whatever GPUs it came with, for a while it still did have the most powerful GPUs you could buy in an Apple computer. And if you needed those GPUs and they had a tool that was asking you a bunch of questions, they should have had a question that said, you know, do you use Maya at Pixar and need this much GPU power? And then it would lead you to the trash can. But I don't know. It's weird. Anyway, if someone at Apple knows why the Mac Pro is omitted from this tool, please tell us. I'm sure it's the obvious reason. Nah, no one should buy that. And we kind of agree, but you're selling it, so put it in the tool.
I'm pretty sure it's very clear why it's omitted.
Like, also, are even, they really
even
selling
when the
it?
Mac Pro, even the very first day this Mac Pro came out, nobody should be buying it. Like, let alone now.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's not nobody. Like, it is the only computer with slots. Like, that's not a great reason for it to exist, and it's not a reason for you to pay twice as much as a Mac Studio. But like, especially since they don't support, I believe they don't support at all anymore, the you know, PCI Express breakout boxes like they used to on the Intel things. It's literally your only choice if you have cards. And that's one of the reasons they should continue to make it and do continue to make it, and they just never ask about that.
Yeah. It made me laugh quite a bit that nobody was coming up with the Mac Pro. And I don't know. Maybe that's a feature, not a bug. I'm just saying. All right. For the main topic this week, for your main course, we have a plethora of different AI-related topics. And I'm going to try to take us on a journey. We'll probably fail, and that's okay. But basically, this next section is AI. Huh. That's a thing, isn't it? And so we start on the 17th of June, for what it's worth, with our friend John Voorhees at Mac Stories, which is them saying, hey, the article is entitled How We're Trying to Protect Mac Stories from AI Bots and Web Crawlers, and How You Can Too. And it seems like both John and Federico are getting very wrapped around the axle with regard to AI stuff. And I'm not saying, I don't mean to imply that they're wrong or that's bad, but they are getting ever more perturbed about what's going on with AI crawlers. And I mean, to a degree, I get it. So that was on the 17th of June. John says, here's how you can protect yourself from crawling. And then on the 21st of June, Business Insider writes and says, OpenAI and Anthropic seem to be ignoring robots.txt. And if you're not familiar, if you have a web page or website, I guess I should say, where you control the entire domain, you can put a file called robots.txt at the root of the domain. So, you know, it would be marco.org/robots.txt. And any self-respecting and ethically clear crawler will start crawling marco.org or whatever the case may be by attempting to load robots.txt and seeing if there's anything there. And if so, there's a mechanism, a schema, if you will, by which the robots.txt will dictate who or really what crawlers should or should not be allowed to crawl that site.
And it's by path. They can say everything in this directory you shouldn't crawl, everything here you can crawl. It's so you can sort of subdivide your site to say which parts are accessible.
Right.
Yeah, and I have thoughts on that, but we'll come back to that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, whenever you're ready to interrupt, to be honest,
okay.
Feel free.
Let's talk about robots.txt.
Well, let me just actually very quickly. Yeah. I apologize. I gave you the green light. Now I'm giving you the yellow light.
All right.
Just very quickly.
I was already.
It's important to note. It's important to note that robots.txt has never been enforced in any meaningful way. It's been kind of a friendly agreement amongst pretty much the entire World Wide Web, but there's never been any real wood behind the arrow or what's the turn of phrase.
It's what we call advisory,
yeah.
Like advisory locking. It is a scheme that people who agree to that scheme can use that scheme to collaborate and work together. But there is no actual mechanism stopping anyone from doing anything. It is literally just a text file that you can choose to read or not.
Right. Yeah.
So with that said, Marco, carry on.
Yeah. And so robots.txt is basically a courtesy. It is a website saying, please maybe follow these rules if you would, you know, but it is not a legal contract. It is not a legal restriction. It is not technically enforced or enforceable, really. And it is also not universally used and respected. And so, and I can tell you, I operate crawlers of a sort, and I don't use robots.txt. So when Overcast crawls podcast feeds, I don't even check for robots.txt. I just crawl the URL as the users have entered them or as they have submitted them to iTunes/Apple Podcasts. That's it. That's like, because I feel like what robots.txt advisories are were originally for was not like, hey, search engines, don't crawl my entire site. That's not what they were for. What they were for was mostly to prevent like runaway crawls on parts of a site that were potentially infinitely generatable. So things like if you have like a web calendar and you can just click that next month, next month, next month button forever if you wanted to. And so a web crawler that like, that, you know, indexes a page and then follows every link on that page, if it's hitting like a web calendar, it can generate basically infinite links as it goes forward or backwards in time. So the main purpose of robots.txt was to kind of advise search engines, and it was specifically for search engines. It was to advise them areas of the site that the crawlers should not crawl, mostly for technical reasons, occasionally for some kind of privacy or restriction reasons, but usually it was just like technical, like, you know, hey, don't get into an infinite loop, which was largely unnecessary because the web crawlers eventually kind of figured out like how to limit things on certain sites, and you know, they eventually made themselves more advanced, and that wasn't really necessary anymore, even for that case.
I think the primary use case was keep this out of your search index.
Generally,
and any decent crawler is not going to get into an infinite loop, but yeah, keep this out of your search index was, you know, and it was respected by the popular search engines of the day, and still is. I think Google still reads robots.txt and still respects it.
Yes, but the thing is, like, it's the whole idea of like, well, I don't want any bot to crawl this. That there, it was so based on assumptions about search engines in particular, web search engines, that I feel like the current drama around trying to apply it to AI training, I think it's missing a lot of that context, that when this kind of unofficial standard was developed, it was all about web search engines. And when you think about like how the web search engine dynamic has always worked with web publishers, there was, and I'm sure we'll talk about this more in a few minutes, but like there was never really any official contract between anybody that said like, hey, Google, Bing, all the other search engines, you know, that have come and gone over the years, crawl my page, go ahead, index it, go ahead, even though technically that is making a copy in your server's memory and might be some kind of copyright violation, doesn't really matter because the purpose of this is going to help me. It's going to make people able to find my page through your search engine and will direct people to my page, and I will be able to have them there, make money, maybe have them subscribe to my site in their browser or whatever. Like, so there was that implied kind of symbiotic trade-off that, okay, I actually, as a site owner, I want search engines to mostly to index my site because I want people to be directed to my site from the search engine. And so robots.txt was entirely in that context. It was never anything that was some kind of like legal contract that said, you must obey my rules. That really has never been tested until fairly recently. Like that was never really something that really ever came up. I mean, there have been a couple of things here and there with like Google News and news publishers in certain countries and stuff, but like for the most part, that the basic idea of robots.txt was really just, please. Like, that's it. It was like, please do this or don't do this. And even then, like, it was often used in ways that harmed the actual customers using things or did things that were unexpected. This is why I don't use it for Overcast's feed crawlers, because if you publish an RSS feed and submit it to Apple Podcasts, I'm pretty sure you intend for that to be a public feed. And so I feel like it is not really my place to then, you know, put up an alert to my users to say, hey, this person's robots.txt file actually says, you know, it's disallow star on this one path that this feed is in, and so I actually can't do this for you. Like that would feel like I would have first of all no incentive to do that, and second of all, because of its intention and context as a standard for search engines, which I'm not, I would also argue, like, I don't really, this doesn't really apply to me and my use. And there were all sorts of things over the years too, like, you know, that you could specify certain user agents, like, all right, Googlebot, do this, Yahoo bot, do this, like, and even, and that was also problematic over the years too, because it disadvantaged certain companies if you just had like bad behavior once, or if a site owner just had like one bad thought about one of these companies once and then like never revisited it or whatever, like, then that company was allegedly like disallowed from crawling the site. Why?
It's not even that. It's like, you know, for people that don't know the technology behind it, you know, don't allow Googlebot. The way you identify Googlebot is by the user agent string, which is part of the HTTP request, and anybody can write anything there.
Yeah.
And so all someone had to do was say, I'm Googlebot, and then just write a script that slams a site. And people are like, oh my God, my site's being slammed by Googlebot. No, it's not. It's being slammed by a thing that put that string into the user agent header. There's no security, no authentication, and it's like email. Anybody, and people forget this about email all the time. That's a real email from Santa at North Pole. Anybody can write anything. I know in email there are technologies to try to make this better, but with HTTP headers, the user agent string, there's no security behind that. So if you're making any decision based on the user agent, whether it's a decision to allow something with a particular user agent string or disallow something, or you try to make decisions about, oh, I'm getting all these hits and I look at the user agent string and the user agent string is X, therefore it must be Google, therefore Google is bad. You have no idea who or what that is, especially with like proxies and things bouncing around the web or whatever. So just like robots.txt, it's all just sort of a politeness agreement and convention that only works when all parties involved are being honest and acting in good faith, and that is not something that is true, broadly speaking, on the web.
Right. And when you're looking at, like, you know, legalities or copyright issues, as I was saying earlier, like, none of this has really ever been tested, because the way it was being used, like, the deal between search engines and publishers was mutually beneficial. And publishers, for the most part, who were not, like, you know, bad business people, like, for the most part, publishers really wanted for search engines to index their public content, and their private content shouldn't be accessible to the crawlers. Like, it shouldn't be exposed to the public internet, like, so if they want it to be private. And so using robots.txt to try to say, I want you to only use the content on my site for this purpose, but not that purpose, but I'm going to keep serving it publicly and making it available to any bot that comes around, like, publicly, you just have to maybe be polite about it. I feel like this is the wrong tool for that job. That job is more of a legal question. That, like, and I think if, like, right now, again, like, we haven't really had much of an agreement between publishers and search engines and other, you know,
I think there have been legal cases about it, especially in the early days, because in the early days of the search engine, the idea that you would go to a website that's not yours and type in a search string and see text that came from your website on someone else's website on the Google search results page, but I believe there were legal cases about that, and I think the result was that Google is allowed to run a search engine, right?
Because right, and some said, of that can be considered fair use. I mean, there's,
yeah, it's like, it was, you know, especially the old style search engines where what you'd see is a series of links that are search results and maybe a summary below them before Google started doing the thing where it's like, actually, I'm just going to give you an entirely unattributed snippet at the top of the page that tries to give you the answer you were looking for without sending you to any site. And of course that snippet is now powered by their large language models, but before it wasn't. That is still up for grabs, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But the basic idea of a search engine that indexes the web and allows you to get links to the things that it has indexed, I believe actually has been tested in court. And either way, whether or not it has been tested in court in your country or in the US or whatever, practically speaking, I don't think there are many this much disagreement about the utility of that. People like having traffic sent to them by Google. There's, you know, arguments of Google being too big and there should be competition in the search space, but the concept, conceptually, a web search engine, I think we all agree, is a good thing that is necessary and should exist and helps everybody.
Sure. But, you know, if you're going to start making, you know, qualifications of like, all right, well, here's how you have to use my content or not use my content, robots.txt is not the way to do that. That is not any kind of legal binding. That is not any kind of technical restriction. I would even question whether it's even a good idea to even still have those files these days, and to expect anything from them.
I think what people are expecting. So we'll read this thing from the Perplexity CEO in a second. But like, I think what people are expecting is for the ostensibly good faith actors to do what the existing ones do. Google honors robot.txt, and so do the other things. Apple honors it with their AppleBot thing. So do the other things that crawl the web, right? Nobody has to follow it, but the good faith actors do. And so I think most of the pushback here is, hey, I thought you weren't just a random, you know, fly-by-night company or a bunch of, you know, script kiddies or whatever. I thought you were a big, important, serious company, and you have a crawler that crawls the web, and I should be able, and you should use a user agent that looks like you, right? And we won't ban your user agent when someone fakes it and spams our site with it, but we'll just say, here are the rules for you. You can't crawl these URLs. You can't crawl any of our URLs. You can crawl these or whatever. Like, I think this is a reasonable tool for that job, provided you understand that the tool only works if the people on the other end agree and say, yes, we will honor your robots.txt. And I think part of the anger is the AI companies are not behaving the way the search engine companies did. And that's the pushback.
So we have a roundup from Michael Tsai that we'll link in the show notes that talks about all this. And then on the same day, on the 21st of June, Perplexity CEO Aravind Srinivas responds to plagiarism and infringement accusations. So this is a post on Fast Company, and Aravind says, and this is a quote, "We don't just rely on our own web crawlers. We rely on third-party web crawlers as well. So it's not my fault. They did it. Right? Over there." Well, who is over there? I don't know. It's the people over there. So reading from the post, and this is a direct quote from the post, but not from Aravind. Srinivas said the mysterious web crawler that Wired identified was not owned by Perplexity, but by a third-party provider of web crawling and indexing services. Srinivas did not say the name of the third-party provider, citing a non-disclosure agreement, asked if Perplexity immediately called the third-party crawler to tell them to stop crawling Wired content. Srinivas was non-committal. Quote, "It's complicated," he said. What is this, Facebook from 10, 20 years ago? Anyways, Srinivas also noted that the robot exclusion protocol, in other words, robots.txt, which was first proposed in 1994, is, quote, "not a legal framework," quote. He suggested that the emergence of AI requires a new kind of working relationship between content creators or publishers and sites like his.
So this is actually something that a bunch of AI CEOs and other bigwigs have been doing, is basically saying, oh, well, don't ask us. We outsource that. And it's like, come on. This is like CEO 101. Yeah, you outsource lots of things, right? But in the end, it's your company. Whatever it's like, you know, if you say, oh, we outsourced it and they're doing something they shouldn't, it's like saying, you know, we outsourced to some company that makes our bread for us at our sandwich shop, and the bread's coming back with shards of glass in it. You don't say, well, don't blame us, we outsource it. Tell your bread maker not to put glass in the bread, right? Or are you saying, you explicitly said, it's okay if you put a little glass in the bread? You know, like, you have to take responsibility, right? And so this is not just the Perplexity CEO. I've seen like three or four stories where AI CEO says, oh, well, that's not us. That's a subcontractor. So we don't have any control over that. It's like, wait, what? Like, just own it. Just say, we've decided we're not going to honor robots.txt, because everyone knows you're not doing it, and you can't try to blame it on a third party thing or whatever, and then defend that. And that's kind of where they go into it. It's like, it's not a legal framework, blah, blah, blah. And like I said, I think the pushback is not like, you know, they're legally required to do this or whatever. It's just that, like, we thought you were going to behave like a search engine, and you were going to be a polite member of web society. And it's clear that because you're like an AI startup, you're like, yeehaw, cowboy time, it's a wild west, you can't fence me in, we're not acting like Google because we don't have to, so tough luck. And that's why people are mad at the companies, right? There's no legal argument here. There's no, like, it's just a decision that they're making. And by the way, Marco, on your decision not to do it, I would say the closest analog of Overcast is that you're a web browser. Web browsers don't honor robot.txt. If you type a URL into the address bar of your web browser, you expect it to load that page. You don't expect it to load robots.txt and say, oh, this site says I'm not supposed to load this page. That's not what robots.txt is for. So if you are a web client used by an individual user, like a user loads an RSS feed in a podcast, that is a single person using a client application to browse the web, you know, to get an RSS feed, right? That is very different than an automated crawler that is crawling all over the entire web and following links, right? That's what robots.txt is for. It's for robots. Unless you are literally a robot while using Overcast, which I don't think you are, It's like Marvelcast should not look at robot subtext because it's not a robot and it's not being used by a robot. I have a whole podcast about this.
Well, but it's like, but if you look at what Perplexity is doing, it's, I think, a lot closer to a browser than a search index.
Well, so Perplexity's business is complicated because it's a whole question of like, do people go there to get links out to other places, or do they go there to get the answer that you attempt to attribute? And I think people get angry with Perplexity when they provide an answer but then don't say where this answer came from. And even if they do say where this answer came from, they're like, you provided too much content. This is the same problem people are beginning to have with Google, is like, you're supposed to be sending me traffic. You're not supposed to be removing traffic, right, by either giving an answer that's synthesized from a website and not telling them the source, or basically like inlining my entire web page, for example, and saying, you don't need to go to that website. Here's the whole page right here. That is not kind of what people expect out of a search engine. So, but Perplexity is so new and so young and they haven't quite figured this out. But it, just at the crawling stage, though, people who are seeing their website crawled and they're going to the Perplexity's service and saying, oh, look, I can find my content there and I put you in robots.txt and you shouldn't be crawling this. Perplexity is like, we don't have to look at robots.txt because that's just an advisory thing and we've chosen to ignore it. And so people are angry. That's what it boils down to.
Well, and I think, you know, there's going to continue to be more and more applications over time of technologies like AI summarization and action models and things like that, where some fancy bot basically is going to be browsing and operating a web page on behalf of a user. That is kind of like a browser, but it's a very different form that I think breaks all those assumptions with publishers. Like, this is one thing that I faced when I was making Instapaper 1,000 years ago, that, you know, Instapaper would save the text of a web page to read later, and only the text, not like all the ads and the images and everything like that. And so I was very careful, though, to not make features that would enable somebody to get the text of a page without having first viewed the page in a browser or a browser-like context. So it would load the whole page. They would see the page. If there were ads, those ads would load on the page. They would see those ads. And then they could save what they were seeing, and then part of that would be saved in paper and shown to them later. And that was always a very tense balance to try to maintain, because, you know, what I didn't want was like widespread scraping of people's text without loading their ads. But I figured that seemed like an okay trade-off, because that was literally just like saving what was already sent to the browser and what the user was already looking at. But a lot of these new technologies, first of all, I probably wouldn't attempt that today, but a lot of these new technologies, I think, break a lot of those little details. Like if you have some kind of bot that's doing something on a website that's like, so, you know, suppose it's one of these action models where you're saying, all right, book me a flight. You know, all this stupid like book me a trip thing that all of these AI demos from these big companies keep trying to do, even though nobody ever wants that. But suppose you have a book me a trip kind of thing with an AI model, and the idea is that model will go behind the scenes and will, you know, go operate, you know, Expedia or Orbitz behind the scenes for you and manipulate things back there to find the best flights and hotels and whatever else. Well, so those sites make some of their money via ads and affiliate things and sponsor placements on those pages. Well, if you have some bot operating the site for you, kind of clicking links for you behind the scenes in some kind of AI context, that bot is not going to see those ads. It's not going to click those affiliate links. It's not going to pick the sponsored listing. It's gonna just kind of get the raw data, and that's it. And that will be violating those sites' business models if that happened. And that really has not happened at massive scale until fairly recently. So this really has not been challenged. This really has not been legally tested that much. This really has not been worked out. Like, what are the standards? What are the laws? What are the legal precedents? How much of this is fair use versus not? You know, for the most part, until very recently, we could pretty much just say, all right, if you serve something publicly via public URLs and anybody can just download it, then nothing bad would really happen to you and your business model for the most part. If some bot came by sometimes and parsed that page for some other purpose, it wasn't a big deal. But now there's a pretty significant difference in scale and type of replacement. Now, with a lot of these AI products and with Google search itself, you know, increasing over time and then more recently rapidly increasing, what we're seeing now is full-out replacement of the need for the user to ever look at that page. That's a pretty big difference on a number of levels, and it's really bad for web publishers and kind of, you know, then consequently really bad for the web in general, that we have a pretty serious set of challenges on the web already, even before this new wave of LLMs came by to further destroy the web. We already had a pretty bad situation for web publishers for lots of other reasons over the years. To have something that removes the need for many people to visit a page at all, that is going to crush publishers. And so it does make sense why everyone's freaking out about this. It makes a lot of sense. I do caution people, though. You can't. I don't think it's a very good business move or a very good technology move to say, I'm going to just block AI from being able to see any of my stuff. Because that's a pretty big hammer, and that's a pretty big blanket statement.
And you can't actually block them anyway. Like, that's what it comes down to. Technically speaking, you can't. You literally can't stop them.
Yeah.
Right?
And so,
unless you stop everyone from viewing your website, in which case you don't have a website.
Right. So I think it is wise to focus on trying to prevent uses of your content that remove the need to visit your page, because that is a direct attack on your business model. That makes a lot of sense. I don't think it's wise to say, I don't want any AI training or any AI visibility of my page. That, I think, is probably short-sighted and probably a bit too much of a blanket statement. And that, I don't think it's good for any party involved to have that kind of blanket ban on it.
I know. Well, what people want, though, that what people, the publishers in particular, want is they want an ecosystem of members who do agree to some rules of politeness and say, look, we should agree on a system that lets me tell you that you shouldn't do X, Y, and Z on my site, and you should agree to it, and we'll feel better about you if you do that. And part of the reason I think Instapaper, your example, was not a particularly big problem is, like you said, scale. And anything with AI in the name these days, people flip out about it and think, this is going to be as big as Google. Instapaper was not as big as Google, right?
No.
It did not have billions and billions and billions of users. If it did, if Instapaper had Google scale, I bet there would have been a hell of a lot more scrutiny on even the very conservative things that you did. But because it was small, it's not a big deal. Like, that's part of the sort of the ecosystem of the web is, there's all sorts of small things that don't have particularly big scale. They're doing all sorts of weird stuff. Nobody cares about them. We allow them to exist. It's fine. But now these big names in AI is the next big thing. You're an AI company. You have a lot of funding. Everyone looks at them and think that could be the next Google. That could be the next thing with billions and billions of users. So we better take whatever weird stuff they're doing way more seriously than we would take Overcast. And with Google, the current giant in the world of search, and they're, you know, trying to replace sites and giving answers on the site or whatever. Neil I. Patel coined a term, I think it was his, about this called Google Zero, which is the point at which publisher websites get zero traffic from Google search, right? Because it's been going down and down over the years because, hey, you'd type Google search and look, the answer to my question that I typed into Google, it's right on the Google results page. It's unattributed, and I don't have to, even if it was attributed, I don't have to click on any link to get to it because the answer is right there. And so Google has been sending less and less traffic to websites, and Google Zero is when you notice, hey, you know what? You know how much traffic we're getting from Google searches? Zero. I don't know if it's absolutely zero for everybody, but it's sure going down, and it's a scary world to have what was once the massively largest source of your traffic to your website disappear. But yeah, like whether or not it is wise to exclude, to ask to be excluded from whatever AI crawler thing from whatever OpenAI, Perplexity, whatever, I think most publishers just simply want that choice. And to have that choice, the crawlers need to agree. Because again, there is no technical way to stop this short of doing like putting your entire site behind a paywall. And even that's not going to stop them because they'll just pay and have their crawler go through it. Like it's the thing about publishing on the web. It's like DRM. You want people to see your movie. You can't make it impossible to see your movie. You have to give the viewer an ability to see your movie. But once you give the viewer the ability to see your movie, they can see your movie. You're like, but what if they see it, but also record it? I want them to see it, but not be able to see it. Can I do that? And the answer is no. Right. So if you're publishing on the web, you have, like, it's like anything else. And that's why Marco was right to call this a legal thing. Like, things are published all the time. They were published in paper, you know, like books or whatever. And it's like, but I can take the book and look at it. I can see all the letters in it. Ha ha, the book is mine. Well, no, actually, we have laws about the stuff that's in that law, that book. We have this thing called copyright. And even though you can technically read it and you can technically copy it increasingly more easily over time with technology, we have laws surrounding it to control what you can do it. And robots.txt, people who think of robots.txt as some kind of like technological bank vault, it's no more of a bank vault than you could put on a book. Like, you do want people to read it, and you can't stop them from being able to copy it. And these days, it's really, really easy to copy a book, especially if it's an ebook, right? Setting aside the whole DRM thing. What you want is some either in a sort of polite society, an agreement among the large parties that actually are significant to get along. And then failing that, you want laws to provide whatever protections you think are due to you. And yeah, the Google search stuff has, I feel like, been hashed out probably in the AltaVista days, but who knows. And the AI stuff has not yet been hashed out. And so to move on to this next one, because we have a lot of these items, Microsoft, at least someone in Microsoft, has a very interesting notion of what the deal is on the web and potentially what the laws should be surrounding it.
So this is a post on The Verge by Sean Hollister, who writes, Microsoft AI boss Mustafa Suleiman incorrectly believes that the moment you publish anything on the open web, it becomes quote-unquote freeware that anyone can freely copy and use. When CNBC's Andrew Ross Sorkin asked him whether AI companies have effectively stolen the world's IP, Mustafa said, I think that with respect to content that's already on the open web, the social contract of that content since the 90s has been that it is fair use. Anyone can copy it, recreate it, reproduce with it. That has been freeware, if you like, and that's been the understanding. Microsoft is currently the target of multiple lawsuits alleging that it and OpenAI are stealing copyrighted online stories to train generative AI models, so it may not surprise you to hear a Microsoft exec defend it as perfectly legal. I just didn't expect them to be so very publicly and obviously wrong. I'm not a lawyer, writes Sean, and that's also true for me. But I can tell you that the moment you create a work, it is automatically protected by copyright in the US. You don't even need to apply for it, and you certainly don't void your rights just by publishing it on the web. In fact, it's so difficult to waive your rights that lawyers had to come up with special web licenses to help. This is so gross. Like, I'm not as riled up as a lot of people about these AI bots crawling my website. Like, it sitting here now, I don't find it that off-putting. I don't love it, but whatever. This, though, this is disgusting.
So this is such a weird statement because everybody knows how copyright works. I'm sure this person knows as well. But to say that, like, oh, it's once you put it on the web, it's freeware, which is a term that mostly applies to software. But, like, the thought is you can recreate it, reproduce it, copy it, like, no. Like, those are specifically the things we actually do have laws around. What we don't have laws around are the more complicated things, like, oh, can I train AI on it or whatever, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But, like, it's such a weird thing to say that, like, oh, as everyone knows, since the 90s, once you put it on the web, you forfeit all ownership. That's not true at all. No. And I mean, that's like, it's one of the things that's great about the web is, oh, it's just like books. It's printed word, right? And especially in the beginning, it was just a bunch of words. And we already have laws surrounding that, right? And that's why there were cases about search engines. Like, are search engines copying it? Because, you know, we got this whole, you know, giant library of laws about copying text. My website has text on it, and Google's copying it. And they had to duke it out and say, actually, what Google's doing is, you know, fine within these parameters, blah, 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 right? But that fight was fought because it was an example of copying. But yeah, this, I mean, obviously the Microsoft AI leadership, this guy is not a lawyer either. That's not how you should defend this. You shouldn't defend it by saying, everything on the web is a free for all, because that's never the way it's been. And it's not the way it is now. This is yet another foot in the mouth problem from Microsoft. I'm not sure what's going on over there, but they really need to, take a lesson from Apple and maybe try to speak with one voice instead of having individual lieutenants make really terrible statements to the press.
Yeah. So Louis Mantia writes with regard to permissions on AI training data from the 22nd of June. Louis writes from John Gruber today on the 22nd of June. It's fair for public data to be excluded on an opt-out basis rather than included on an opt-in one. And then Louis continues, no, it's not. This is a critical thing about ownership and copyright in the world. We own what we make the moment we make it. Publishing text or images on the web does not make it fair game for to train AI on. The public and public web means free to access. It does not mean free to use. Also, whether reposting my content elsewhere is in good faith or not, it is now up to someone other than me to declare whether or not to disallow AI training web crawlers in their robots.txt file. To allow, excuse me, to add insult to injury, that person may not have the knowledge or even the power to do so if they're posting content they don't own on a site that they also don't own, like social media.
So this is, he's so close to getting to the crux of this. In the first little paragraph here, he's basically declaring that training AI on your data is exactly the same as copying and reproducing it. And that is not something that the world agrees on. Louis's opinion is that it is. The courts have not yet weighed in. I think to the average person, they would say, are those the same things? Because they seem like they might be a little bit different. Kind of in the same way that indexing your content in Google is a little bit different than just literally copying it and reposting it on the website, right? But anyway, if you agree that it's the same as copying, then yeah, sure. But then the second bit is getting to even more of the heart of it here, which is like, okay, so let's say we do agree that it's the same, which, you know, not proven yet, but anyway. What about when somebody like posts a link to your site on a social media network, and on that website they do a little embedding inlining of like the first paragraph or whatever? Or like, what if someone copies and pastes a paragraph of your thing and on another website, right? Even if you had absolute somehow magical technical control to stop AI crawlers from crawling your website, if people can read your website and quote from it or embed little portions of it or a screenshot or do whatever on other websites, of course you don't control those other websites. And so if they allow crawling, your stuff's going to end up in the Google search index, in the AI training model or whatever, even though you disallowed it from your website. And I would say that for the most part, that we also have laws covering, can someone take a portion of the thing that you made and quote it elsewhere? There's all legal framework deciding whether that is fair use or not, and it's complicated, and the law is not a deterministic machine, as Neil Patel, who I mentioned before, is always fond of saying. But we do have a legal framework to determine, can I copy and paste this paragraph from this thing on this person's site and quote it on my site so I can comment on it? Yeah, in general, you can. You know, can I make a parody of this this article, you know, on my website? Yeah, you can. There's a whole bunch of things around that you know that have been fought out in court that we have a system for dealing with. But all of those things, say the court determines you sue them and they say, actually, this person was allowed to quote that snippet, right? You lost your fair use case because it's pretty open and shut. That's fine. That just got indexed by an AI training bot because that person's website allows them, you know, the polite AI bots, or never mind that you can't stop them. Anyway, right? That's just the nature of publishing. No matter what, you do not have absolute control over every single character that you made. You do have control over the entire work and the reproduction of the entire work, but you don't have control over other examples of fair use. And Louis saying, oh, it shouldn't be like, I shouldn't have to opt out. The default should be that nobody can crawl me. I mean, that's just, like, not only is it technically impossible, but, like, that's not the way the web has ever worked. It has always been, we're going to crawl you unless you tell us don't. And even the polite ones, you know, they'll read the thing that you said not to do it, but by default, they're going to crawl you. And I think asking for a world where everything you publish on your website is not only not crawlable by the things you don't want it to crawl, but also not able to be quoted by other people is clawing back rights that we've already decided belong to other people through fair use.
So then the music industry decided to get involved.
Multi-billion-dollar companies are entered the chat, as they would say. Mm-hmm. We talked about this before of like, hey, Louis Mantine doesn't want people crawling his website. What can he do about it? He's just one person. The music industry, they have a lot of money. They have a lot of IP. This is where the stuff really starts going down.
Yeah, so reading from Ars Technica on the 24th of June, Universal Music Group, Sony Music, and Warner Records have sued AI music synthesis companies Udio and Suno for allegedly committing mass copyright infringement by using recordings owned by the labels to train music-generating AI models. The lawsuits filed in federal courts in New York and Massachusetts claim that the AI company's use of copyrighted material to train their systems could lead to AI-generated music that directly competes with and potentially devalues the work of human artists. The Verge writes on the same day, And these are straightforward cases of copyright infringement. Oh, hello, future Marco. Hi. I should probably preface who this is. All right, let me try that again. So from the Verge article, there's a quote from RIAA Chief Legal Officer Ken Doroshow, and that quote is, "These are straightforward cases of copyright infringement involving unlicensed copying of sound recordings on a massive scale. Suno and Udio are attempting to hide the full scope of their infringement rather than putting their services on a sound and lawful footing." And again, that was the RIAA Chief Legal Officer. Mikey Shulman, the CEO of Suno, says the company's technology is transformative and designed to generate completely new outputs, not to memorize and regurgitate pre-existing content. Shulman says Suno doesn't allow user prompts based on specific artists. Reading from the lawsuit, the use here is far from transformative, as there is no functional purpose for Suno's AI model to ingest the copyrighted recordings other than to spit out new competing music files. That Suno is copying the copyrighted recordings for a commercial purpose and is deriving revenue directly proportional to the number of music files it generates further tilts the fair use factor against it. Andy Bayo writes, 404 Media pulled together a video montage of some of the AI-generated examples provided in the two lawsuits that sound similar to famous songs and their recording artists. Then finally, we'll put a link in the show notes to a Verge article that discusses what the RIAA lawsuits mean for AI and copyright. You know, I saw somebody say this a few days ago. I don't remember who exactly it was, but what's going on if the RIAA are suddenly the good guys? This is a weird place to be.
Are they, though? So here's the thing. Like, this is the tricky bit with this. And we talked about this with image generators or whatever. So this is significant because they're big, rich companies, and you have to take them seriously when they bring a lawsuit, because this is the kind of, like, who can stop OpenAI and Google and whatever? Well, you know, it's Clash of Titans. You need other titans in here to be duking it out, right? This needs to be fought out in a court in some way. I say that before we see what the result will be, because maybe the result is not what we want to happen. But, like, as with the image things, these companies that, you know, you type in a string and they produce a song for you, right? These models are trained on stuff. And these record labels say, yeah, you trained them on all our music, right? Gets back to the question, is training something? Is AI training? How does that relate to copying? Is it just like copying? Is it not like copying at all? Is it somewhere in the middle? Do any of our existing laws apply to it? And we've discussed this on past episodes as well. Especially when the company doing the training then has a product that they make money on. And as I said with the image training, these models that make songs are worthless without data to train them on. The model is nothing without the training data. This company that wants to make money, you pay us X dollars, you can make Y songs, right? That's their business model. They can make zero songs if they have not trained their model on songs. So the question is, where do those songs come from? If they've licensed them from somebody, if they made the songs themselves, no problem, right? Again, Adobe training their, like, image generation models entirely on content they either own or licensed. Nobody's angry about that. That's the thing you're doing. You own a bunch of images, you license them from a stock photo company or whatever, you train your models on them, you put the feature into Photoshop, you charge people money for Photoshop, they click a button, it generates an image. Whether people like that feature or whatever, legality seems fine. These other situations where it's like, hey, we crawled your site because we don't care about your robots.txt. We trained our models on your data, on your songs, on your whatever, right? And by the way, we have no idea if these companies actually paid for all the songs. Let's just assume they did. They bought all the songs from, you know, Sony Music, Warner Records, or whatever, or they paid for a streaming service. They got all the songs. They trained their model on. Then they're charging people to use their model, right? Just like the image processing, I've always thought that if you have a business that would not be able to exist without content from somebody that you did not pay anything for, that is very different than, oh, we trained an AI model for research purposes, or we trained it for, you know, for some purchase that is not, like, literally making money off of you. And this particular case is like, okay, not just that they're making money, but the thing they're providing is, quote, not transformative. They keep using that word because that's one of the tests for, like, fair use. Is the work transformative? Have they taken the thing that existed but made something new out of it? And that's, they'll argue that in court, whether it is or not. Is not transformative. And also, is it a substitute? This is another one of the fair use tests. Is it a substitute for the product? Is someone not going to buy a Drake album because fake Drake sounds just as good, and they just listen to fake Drake, right? Is it a substitute for it? Doesn't mean, does this sound exactly like it? That's a whole other sad area of law of, like, does song A sound too much like song B and they have to pay them whatever when they're all made by humans, right? This is like, you know, would someone pay for this instead of paying for this? Is one a substitute for the other? And that's what they'll be duking it out about. But I think at its root, it is sort of like, where does the value of this company come from? You know, like, every company has to take inputs from somewhere. They, you know, manufacture something and they sell it to you, or they have a service, they wrote the software for it, they pay someone to run the servers and they sell it. Like, there's sort of a value chain there. And a lot of these companies are like, we would make more money if we don't have to pay for the things that make our product valuable. So we don't want to have to license all the music in the world, but we do want to train an AI model on all the music in the world so that we can make songs that sound as good as all the music in the world, but we don't want to have to pay for any of that. And that seems to be not a good idea from my perspective. And this is one of, like, the different ways you can look at this. Moral, ethical, legal. I think one of the frameworks that I've falling back on a lot is practical. If, you know, for any given thing, say, if we allowed this to happen, would it produce a viable, sustainable ecosystem? Like, would it produce a market for products and services? Would it be a rising tide that lifts all boats? Or would it, like, burn the forest to the ground and leave one tree left in the middle? Right? You know what I mean? Like, that practical approach, people like to jump on, like we talked about before with Vitici and Mac Stories and everything. Like, they want to go to the moral and ethical thing. They're stealing from us. It's our stuff. They have no right. And even what I was saying before, like, oh, they don't want to pay for this stuff, but they want to make money off of it or whatever. But practically speaking, this is not the way the law works, but this is the way I think about it. Practically speaking, I'm always asking myself, if this is allowed to fly, what does this look like? Fast forward this. What, you know, is this viable, right? What if everyone's listening to fake Drake, does Drake, the next Drake, are not able to make any money? Does human beings making music become an unviable business, and all it is just an increasingly gray soup of AI-generated stuff that loops in on itself over and over again, right? Like, where are the, you know, and we have the same thing with publishing on the web. Like, does Google destroy the entire web because no one needs to go to websites anymore and they just go to Google, right? Unfortunately, when these cases go, you know, to court, no one is thinking that. That's not how the law works. Again, the law is going to be, is this fair use, whatever? Does Congress pass new laws related to this or whatever? But what I really hope is that the outcome of all these things, and the thing I'm always rooting for, is can we get to a point where we have an ecosystem that is sustainable? Which means it's probably, you know, whatever they're suing for is, like, I think they want like $150,000 for every song or something. That is not a sustainable solution. You can't train an AI model when you pay $150,000 for each song that you trained it on, because you need basically all the songs in the world. That's a big number. That's stupid. We do want AIs that can make little songs, right? I think that is a useful thing to have, right? So we need to find a way where we can have that, but also still have music artists who can make money making actual music, setting aside the fact that the labels take all the money and the artists get barely anything anyway, which is its own
separate
problem.
Issue.
Right. And there was a good article about that recently, about how the labels, Spotify and the artists, and the terrible relationship there that screws over artists. Anyway, I think I really hope that the outcome of this is some kind of situation where there's something sustainable. There's like I keep using ecosystem, but it's like, you know, you have to have enough water, the whole water cycle, this animal eats that animal, it dies, it fertilizes the plant, like the whole, you know, a sustainable ecosystem where everything works and it goes all around in a circle and everything is healthy and there's growth, but not too much and not too cancerous, and it's not like everything is replaced by a monoculture and only one company is left standing and all that good stuff, right? But right now, the technology is advancing in a way that if we don't do something about it, the individual parties involved are not motivated to make a sustainable ecosystem, let's say. I mean, that's kind of what the DMA is about in the EU. And these AI companies definitely are not motivated to try to make sure they have a sustainable ecosystem. They just want to make money. And if they can do it by taking the world's music and selling the ability for you to make songs that sound like it without paying anything to the music that they ingested, they're going to try to do that.
Yeah, it's... I don't know. It's all just so weird and gross. And it's hard because I don't want to be old man who shakes fist at clouds, right? And it seems like AI, for all the good and bad associated with it, is a thing. It's certainly a flash in the pan for right now, but I get the feeling that where blockchain and Bitcoin and all that sort of stuff was very trendy, but anyone with a couple of brain cells to rub together would say, eh, that's all going to fade, or it's certainly not going to work the way it is today. I think there's a little of that here, but I get the feeling that this is going to stick around for a lot longer. And I think that there needs to be some wrangling done, some legal wrangling. And I get the move fast and break things mentality of these startups that are doing all this, but I don't know. It just feels kind of wrong. Like, again, I'm not nearly as bothered by it as some of our peers are, but it just doesn't feel right. And
I mean, it definitely doesn't feel sustainable, like practically speaking. True. Like, if like regardless of how you feel about it, right or wrong, if you say, if we just let them do this, like, and these, you know, these models get better and better and produce more and more acceptable content, you can see that it's taking, again, regardless of how this lawsuit ends up with the whole record labels, you can see that it is taking value away from human beings making music and pushing that value to models making music. But those models are absolutely worthless without that human-generated music, at least initially, right? Again, maybe in the future there will be models trained entirely on model-generated music, but then you have to trace it back to where that model get trained. Like, in the end, these models are trained on human-created stuff, and there may not be enough officially licensed human-created stuff to train them on at this point. I think that's, you know, I think we want these tools. They are useful for doing things. Even if you think, oh, they make terrible music, sometimes people need terrible music, right? Sometimes people just need a little jingle. They can describe it. They want it to be spit out, right?
I mean, by most people's definitions, all of my music is terrible music.
they do useful things. Like, unlike, you know, cryptocurrency, which does a very, very small number of useful things that is not in general purpose, the, you know, AI models do tons of useful things. Apple's building a bunch into their operating systems. You know, people use them all the time. They do tons of useful things, right? We should find a way for them to do those things without destroying the ecosystem. I think we can find a way for that to happen. If you look at the awful situation with like Spotify and record labels and music artists, that's a pretty bad version of this. And yet still, it is better than Spotify saying we're going to stream all these songs for free and not pay anybody, right? I wish I could find that article for the notes. I'll try to look it up. But even that is better than the current situation with AI, which is like, we're just going to take it all for free. Come sue us. And they say, okay, we are suing you. And they'll battle it out in court. But like, either way this decision goes with the music thing, it could go bad in both directions. Because if they say, oh, you're totally copying this music, all AI training is illegal, that's terrible. That's bad. We don't want that, right? And if they say, no, it's fine, it's transformative, you can take anything you want for free, that's also bad. So both extremes of the potential decision that a court could make based on this lawsuit are really bad for all of us for the future. So that's why I hope we find some kind of middle ground. Like, and again, with Spotify, they came up with a licensing scheme where they can say, we want to stream your entire catalog of music. Can we figure out a way to exchange money where you will allow that to happen legally? And they came up with something. It's not a great system they came up with. Again, if I can find that article, you can read it and see how bad it is. But they didn't just take it all for free, right? And they also didn't, the music labels didn't say, okay, but every time someone streams one of these songs, it's $150,000, right? That's also not sustainable. So obviously they're staking out positions in these lawsuits and they're trying to put these companies out of business with big fees or whatever. But yeah, this is like, it's scary. It's scary when titans clash. And I do worry about what the result of these cases are going to be. But I think, either think we have to have these cases, or, and I know this is ridiculous in our country, or we have to make new laws to address this specific case, which is different enough from all the things that have come before it that we should have new laws to address it. And it would be better if those laws weren't created by court decisions, but our ability and track record for creating technology-related laws for new technology is not great in this country. So there's that.
Yeah, and then it continues, because Figma, a popular, I don't know how to describe this, like a user interface generation tool.
Design tool.
Yeah, design tool. Thank you. They pulled their AI tool after criticism that it blatantly ripped off Apple's weather app. So this is The Verge by Peters. Figma's new tool, Make Designs, lets users quickly mock up apps using generative AI. Now it's been pulled after the tool drafted designs that looked strikingly similar to Apple's iOS weather app. In a Tuesday interview with Figma CTO Chris Rasmussen, I asked him point blank if Make Designs was trained on Apple's app designs. His response, he couldn't say for sure. Figma was not responsible for the training AI models it used at all.
Who knows who trained it? It's just our model. We don't. I don't know who trained. Do you know who trained? I don't know. Does anyone know who trained it? It's just we just found it on our doorstep, and this is a model.
Yep, would the real trainer please stand up? Quote: "We did no training as part of the generative AI features," Rasmussen said. "The features are," quote, "powered by off-the-shelf models and a bespoke design system that we commissioned, which appears to be the underlying issue." So if you commissioned it, then
we had someone else do it, and they gave it to us, and we just took it, and we're like, we didn't ask too many questions. We're just like, it's fine. Whatever you got, just give it. It's probably fine.
The key AI models that power Make Designs are OpenAI's GPT-4o and Amazon's Titan Image Generator G1, according to Rasmussen. If it's true that Figma didn't train its AI tools, but they're spitting out Apple app lookalikes anyway, that could suggest that OpenAI or Amazon's models were trained on Apple's designs. OpenAI and Amazon didn't immediately reply to a request for comment. This is seriously the Spider-Man pointing at other Spider-Man's image. It's not my fault. It's their fault. Well, it's not my fault. It's their fault. Oh, no. It's not my fault. It's their fault.
Well, it was that company. I think it was OpenAI or whatever. The Sora model that makes movies, essentially. That someone who was responsible for that was asked in an interview, was your model trained on YouTube? They're like, they didn't give an answer. Like, well, maybe, I don't know. Listen, if you run an AI company, figure out how and where your models were trained. I don't know what you like. Maybe you train them on good things, bad things, whatever, but have an answer. Don't say, we don't know. Someone else did it. We like, this seems like table stakes. Like, you should know where and on what your model was trained. Not like granular, like every single individual thing, although ideally that would be great, but this is too much. I get it, right? But when someone says, hey, did you train on YouTube? You should be able to answer that with a yes or a no, right? Not weasel about it. And this one, was this trained on Apple's apps? I mean, anyone looking at it is going to be like, well, if it wasn't, this is the world's biggest coincidence because it looks just like Apple's app. As Gruber pointed out, right down to the really weird line chart that I never really understood until I saw it explained in Apple's weather app, right? It was obviously trained on Apple stuff. But you have to have an answer, right? If you don't have an answer, say, I don't know, but I'll find out for you. And then come back. But, the bar is real low here. Anyway, same situation, different thing. Images, songs, text, UIs, a mock-up tool that makes UIs. It's based on a model. That model is worthless without being trained on a bunch of UIs. Were you going to get enough UIs to train it from the world of UIs that we take essentially without permission? Is that okay? If we sell that as part of our application, is that okay? I mean, I wrote a big post about this, what, in January?
I made this.
Yeah. We talked about it on the podcast before, and I took a while to write this because, actually, speaking of Neil Patel, I was listening to the Decoder podcast, and there was an episode where I was debating with somebody about the New York Times lawsuit at the time. New York Times was suing some company that had trained its AI on the New York Times, and they said, you can't do that, and going back and forth about the model is just doing what a person would do and it's learning and blah, blah, blah. And is the person the same as the model? Does the model have the same rights as the person? And I was trying to write up something related to that. And as usual, writing helps me clarify my thinking, but it is a fairly complicated circuitous route to sort of really dig down into that thought to get to what's at the heart of it. And I wrote this thing and I think I did get to the heart of it as far as I was concerned, but it's complicated. So every time I try to summarize it on the podcast, I find myself tongue-tied and you just quote from the paragraphs. I think if you read the post, my thoughts are in there, but a lot of people have read it and no one has commented on it. So maybe I'm doing a poor job communicating it, but I was coming at it from the other angle. We talked all about training data in this section of the show here. I was coming at it from the angle of what was then one of the hot topics, which is say I use one of these tools. Say I use the Figma tool to generate a UI. I use the song tool to generate a song or whatever. That thing that I made, what is the legal, ethical, moral, practical ownership deal with that? If I use Figma to make that auto-create UI thing and it makes me a UI and I put that in my app, do I own that UI? If I make a song with the song-making tools, do I have the copyright on that song? There's been legal cases about this, and I think the only ruling we have now is something like if you make it with an AI-generated tool, you don't have the copyright on it or whatever. But the reason I got to that, because I was getting with the whole oh, you know, training is just like what a human would do. They read all these articles in the New York Times, then you ask the human the answer, and they read all those articles, and they know have the knowledge from reading those articles, and they give you an answer. Well, that's just what our AIs are doing. I'm like, yeah, but a human is a human, and AI is an AI, and is that really what the root of the thing it is? And I kept chasing that down, chasing that thought down, and got to sort of the thing that confers ownership, right? Like, when you make something, it's yours. You write something on your blog, you have the copyright to it because you created it. It's so clear, right? What if you draw a picture on a piece of paper? Okay, you got the copyright on the picture, right? What if you use Photoshop to make a picture? Well, now you use this software tool written by a bunch of other people, just plain old Photoshop, not like AI generated, like Photoshop 3.0, right, with layers now. You use Photoshop, but you didn't write Photoshop. A bunch of people wrote software to make Photoshop, then you then paid Adobe for, then they gave you that software product. You use Photoshop to make a picture, but still we say, well, you made that picture. You have the copyright on it. You are the creator. You own it, right? Then we say, all right, but what if you can't draw? What if you tell somebody, like, I can't draw. Here's what I want. I want this picture of whatever example I gave a thing, a polar bear riding a skateboard, but I can't draw. So I ask somebody else, say, can you draw me a picture of a polar bear riding a skateboard? So someone goes and they draw a picture of a polar bear riding a skateboard. At that point, the person who drew it owns it. Maybe they use Photoshop, maybe they don't. But they own it because they created it. They drew it, right? But then you say, okay, this was a work for hire. I'll give you $10. And our contract says, I give you $10, you give me the polar bear drawing. Now I own the polar bear drawing because I paid you for it. That is a market for creative works. Someone was an artist. I can't draw. They could. They drew it. They asked for money. I gave them money. They gave me the ownership of the polar bear drawing. The copyright is now mine, right? And the act of creation is clear. The person who drew it, they created it. I paid money for it. They sold me their creation. Now I own it. All, you know, normal, right? Now I say, make me a picture of a polar bear on a skateboard. But I don't say it to an artist. I say it to an image generator. It's the exact same thing as I did before. Before, when I did it, it was clear that I don't own anything until I pay for that, right? Now, when I do that exact thing, but instead of typing it into an email to an artist, I type it into an image generator and I get an image back. Who created that image? I didn't create it. Because if you're going to say I didn't create the one that the artist drew for me, because you just told the artist what to draw, but you didn't create it. Well, if I didn't create that one, I certainly didn't create this one because I literally did the same thing. I just typed the text in a different text field. It could literally be the same text. It could be an AI prompt emailed to an artist or sent to an AI. So I'm not going to say that I am the creator of that. The AI model can't be the creator because computer programs can't own things. They don't have rights. Computer programs are made by people who have rights, just like people who wrote Photoshop, they have the rights to Photoshop and so on and so forth. But the people who wrote Photoshop have no rights to the things that people made with Photoshop, despite Adobe's little snafu with their license agreements recently, which they clarified. But anyway, so I didn't make that picture of the polar bear. The large language model didn't make it. Who owns that picture of the polar bear based on the act of creation? Where is the act of creation there? How did that model create the polar bear? Well, it created the polar bear picture because it had been trained on tons of other images that maybe were or weren't licensed. But still, I'm looking around of like, if ownership is conferred by the act of creation and there's no act of creation here, what the hell are we, what's going on here? Who owns the picture of the polar bear? And that, like, every time I dig down into some kind of like, oh, AI is allowed to do this and you're allowed to train and it's just what people do or whatever and computers aren't people or whatever, I always go through to looking for how we confer ownership of stuff like this, how we confer ownership of intellectual property, how we exchange money for intellectual property, how the market for intellectual property works. And none of the existing systems make any sense in a world where I can say the same thing to a human and a generator that is clearly not me creating anything, and yet I do get a picture out of it that came from somewhere, and there's no, like, there's no human actor created. It's an indirection, right? And so I think we need new ways to think about and new laws for that type of indirection to say, what is the chain of ownership here? It's kind of like, not quite the same thing, but remember the whole thing where, like, the monkey took a picture of itself with the camera? Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was like a camera set up in the jungle or whatever, and a monkey comes up to it and snaps a picture of himself. And the photographer is like, well, it's my camera, so I own the copyright to that picture. And I'm like, well, doesn't the monkey own the copyright? Because it took the picture, right? And it's like, but the monkey can't own the copyright. It's not a person, right? And believe me, a monkey is way closer to a sentient being than an LLM, right? It's like, it's a real living thing. No one's going to argue in court that a monkey is not alive. And they're going to say, well, does it have legal rights? Well, I would say a monkey has more legal rights than a large language model, which is just a bunch of numbers in memory, right? And so this is the kind of conversation we're having. And it would, honestly, this would be so much easier to have if we had actual artificial intelligence, as in sentient artificial beings. But we don't. That's just science fiction. Large language models are not anywhere close to that. That would be so much easier, because you'd be like, well, conscious beings have rights, and we need the, you know, whatever. They always have names of this in sci-fi movies. The AI Consciousness Act of 2732 that gives rights to the AIs to avert a global war and plunge us into the Matrix apocalypse. You know what I mean? Like, it's so much easier when you say, well, people have rights, and computer programs that are basically people have rights, and it's straightforward. But we're nowhere near there. So now we're arguing about monkeys, if they have the copyright pictures, and we're arguing about huge matrices of numbers, whether they can create anything. Or you're saying, like, oh, you're saying basically, like, the people who wrote Photoshop own every picture that's made from it. He's like, well, no, the LLM doesn't own it, and the person who wrote the prompt doesn't own it. But you know who does own it? OpenAI. Because they wrote the program that crawled all the pictures in the world, that trained the model that you paid to use. None of those answers are satisfactory in any way. Like, it doesn't feel right, it doesn't seem right, it doesn't seem sustainable, and yet we do need some kind of answer here. Even if the answer here is that anything, again, like that one law precedent we had, is like, if you make something out of AI, you don't own the copyright on it, it is not copyrightable, nobody owns it, it's garbage, it's slop, it's a thing that exists, but nobody can claim that they own it, so it is free for anybody to take and do whatever they want with, but you certainly can't, like, sell it to someone because you didn't own it. It's very confusing. I know that I haven't made this any clearer. You can try reading my post to see if it becomes any more clear, but really, this is a dizzying topic if you think about it for any amount of time, and I think a lot of people are doing a lot of feeling about it, which makes perfect sense. And honestly, it is more straightforward to feel things about it than it is to think about it, because thinking about it gets you into some weird corners real fast.
Yeah, it's just, it's a mess. And it's a mess, and I don't know what the right answer is, right? Like, it's so gray from top to bottom, and I don't know. I just don't know.
Well, and I think we're going to have to be fighting this and working this out for a while. I mean, look at how much disruption to existing businesses, existing copyright law, and existing norms was caused by the web and then the rise of other things on the internet. Like, this is how technology goes. There are massive disruptions to what has been established, what many people have held dearly. There's massive disruptions to that when new tech comes around sometimes. And sometimes it takes a decade or two to really settle out and work out what are the norms, what should the laws be, what does copyright mean in this new world, things like that. Like, that takes a long time to work out sometimes. I think the rise of these AI techniques and models is potentially as disruptive to existing business models and norms and perspectives as the web was when it first came out 1,000 years ago. So I really think we're in for a while of just not knowing. There's going to be a lot of damage and destruction along the path to get from where we are now to where things settle out. It will destroy a lot of businesses, and it will, you know, make it hard for a lot of people to do what they've been doing. It will also create a bunch of new businesses and create a bunch of new value and new opportunities, just like any other massive disruption. I think this is a very large disruption, and it's mostly only going to start to become visible of, like, you know, what the other side looks like just after a bunch of time has passed and we've gone through a bunch of messiness, and we're in such early days, it's really hard to know where we're going to end up right now.
I feel like this is going to be, in some respects, not all, but in some respects, even more disruptive than the initial web, because the initial web was kind of like text. We have laws governing that. It was a massive shift of wealth. Obviously, newspapers go out of business. Craigslist gets rich. You know what I mean? Like, but we saw that giant shift in paper magazines, like the shift of publishing, right? And web search and doing all that or whatever. But during that entire thing, people were upset, and it was a big turmoil, because it was like, these things used to be huge. Every city had 25 newspapers. A newspaper reporter was a big job. And, you know, it's like, and all of a sudden all that money's going elsewhere to these .com things or whatever. But during that whole process, there was mostly agreement that, like, newspapers own what they publish. Websites own what they publish. Like, we have existing copyright laws for this. There's the whole Google search index thing that we can figure out. And, you know, fair use on the internet and stuff. But in general, it was just a massive shift of power and money from older industries to newer ones, mostly following along the shape of laws and ideas and morals and ethics and societal understanding about the written word, mostly in the early days of the web. Especially before social media, we really came and mixed that up a little bit, right? With the whole aggregation of humans all talking to each other and quoting things and linking out or whatever, right? That, in hindsight, that seems much less disruptive than this AI stuff, which is like, it's a free-for-all. No one knows anything. No one knows what's legal, what's not, what's sustainable, what's not, what should we do, what can we do, what are people doing, how valuable is this, how useful is it? How, like, just so many questions, and we, like, all of the laws that we have that seems like they could apply to this, and some of them do apply, it's like, yeah, but there's these huge areas where it's like, here be dragons, or on the map, they draw the big dragon, and the thing is like, nobody knows what's there. And there's a lot of money behind it, and a lot of people running in that direction, and it's not even clear where or how this will shift the power. Like, in the internet in the early days, it was pretty clear, paper newspapers, power is going away from them, and towards websites. Like, that trend was visible to anybody with a clue, and it was just a question of how fast, how hard, you know, whatever. Here, is this going to shift power massively to the record labels because they own all the music, for example? Or is it going to destroy them because everything they have is now worthless because AI models can be trained on it and it's a perfect substitute for what they previously made and no one wants anything? Like, you can't even tell which direction it's going to go at this point. It's so early, and I just don't think that was true of the web. So this is an exciting time to be alive in many ways, especially if you're in any industry, any creative industry that involves intellectual property that AI touches at all. And at this point, that's nearly all of them, right? And right now, AI, what it does is not, you know, not particularly amazing, but it is good enough for so many use cases, and this stuff generally doesn't get worse over time.
All right. Thank you to our sponsors this week, 1Password and Photon Camera. And thank you to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atv.fm/join. Members get a bunch of perks, including ATP Overtime. This is our weekly bonus topic that's an extra segment that only members get to hear. ATP Overtime this week is going to be about a rumor reported by The Information and Mark Gurman about some changes and plans to what Apple is going to be working on for the next Vision Pro. And kind of what they can maybe do to make the next Vision Pro cheaper and how they're going to possibly do this and everything. That's what we're talking about in ATP Overtime this week. Join now to listen, atp.fm/join. Thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
Not so real-time follow-up on my earlier statement about Apple Silicon Macs not being able to use PCI breakout boxes. That is not true. You can use Thunderbolt PCI breakout boxes. Obviously,
yeah,
you can't.
Yeah, it's just
use...
not GPUs.
Yeah, but you can't use GPUs internally either. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So, still, Apple should have put the Mac Pro in the configurator. Or I suppose they could have said, hey, do you use PCI cards? Well, you can use PCI cards? Well, you can buy a Mac Studio and also this third-party product that we don't even sell, or you can buy a Mac Pro, which is a product in their lineup.
No, I think two things are simultaneously true. Number one, they should keep making the Mac Pro because it does have uses. And number two, absolutely nobody should buy the Mac Pro effectively. Like, if anybody who's going to a page on Apple.com saying, what Mac should I buy? None of those people should buy it. None.
No, they should. That should be, look, the whole point of this is, which it's a path that leads to all of our products. And maybe there's only one very lonely, overgrown path that leads to the Mac Pro, but it's got to be there. Look, I would say number three, your product chooser should let you choose from any of the products, depending on which things you answer. Put as many scary questions in there as you want. There's just got to be a path that lands in the Mac Pro. Because otherwise, like, look, what they're saying with this is, no one should buy this product. And I don't think Apple believes that. If you ask them, they said, well, some people should. Like, okay, great, but you have a tool that lets people choose, and it has every single Mac you sell except for that one. That just seems like a bug to me. Someone should report it, and they should fix it.
You should report it.
You do.
I just want them to make a Mac Pro that's worth buying.
I mean, that's a bug.
That is. Maybe they're working on that. We'll see.
I don't know.
So what, I mean, I feel like we covered this in the past, but what are you waiting for? Like, what would make it worth
buying? I mean, am I waiting for anything in particular? I don't know. Like, because, again, with the gaming situation on Apple Silicon Macs is entirely unclear. If I did buy a Mac with a big, beefy GPU, like bigger than a Mac Studio GPU, that would be a speculative purchase. It would not be like my current Mac Pro, which I literally knew I could run Windows games on and do, and they work fine, and I run literally put into Windows. Like, that's not speculative. That's a thing, right? If I buy, if I decide, hey, I want a bigger than Mac Studio GPU and an ARM Mac, I am like crossing my fingers that some magical point in the future I will be able to do interesting gaming things on it. I don't know if I'm going to make that speculative purchase. I don't know if Apple's going to make a Mac with a better than Mac Studio GPU in it. And maybe they make it, and it's just too rich for my blood, and I can't spend that much money on something speculative, right? Like I said, my default is an M4 Mumble Mac Studio is potentially the computer I'll replace this with whenever they release that, like next year or towards the end of this year or whatever. But I would like to see, you know, show me something. Show me the Mac Pro. Show me something that's not a Mac Studio in a giant cavernous case, right? That's what I would like to see from them, and then I can decide. Is it worth it for me to get that? Because it's not a slam dunk like the 20... Well, it's not as big a slam dunk as the 2019 was. Because, again, this was not speculative. But it's just kind of wishful thinking at this point to think you're going to be running Windows ARM games natively on... You know, you're going to be booting Windows for ARM on your, you know, Apple Silicon Mac Pro. Or you're going to be running Windows caliber games in macOS. Because Apple will have gotten all the AAA game developers on board. That is all just a twinkle in someone's eye right now. It is not a real thing.
I feel like, and I'm going to say this, and I know and I understand why it's not appealing to you, but I feel like so many of your problems would, well, maybe not even problems, but so much of your life would be so much better if you would just get a damn Mac Studio and a damn Windows PC. And I get it. I don't want to run Windows anything. I don't. and I know you are even worse than me in this capacity, but like, that would make so many things so much better.
I would probably have a gaming PC if I had a place in the house for it, but I don't. So,
I mean, I hate to break it to you, but I really don't think that there is ever going to be a Mac Pro that does the things that your current Mac Pro does. And yeah.
I mean, that may be true. Like, I'm rooting for it, but like right now, the outlook doesn't look so great.
Yeah, I would definitely not hold your breath on that.
I mean, like, the thing is, it's actually kind of, if I thought like 2 years ago, like, predicted how this would go. Actually, I'm kind of surprised at how much motion there is here. The Copilot Plus PC, how hard Microsoft is pushing into ARM PCs after doing such a bad job with Windows RT, right? Apple with its whole game porting toolkit. Like, both those parties, both Microsoft and Apple, are actually surprising me with how hard they're trying to make my dream happen. They're just not succeeding, right? But they are. They're trying more than I thought they would, right? I didn't think they'd be like, both on both sides, I have been pleasantly surprised by the additional effort that they're putting in. I think everyone kind of is. It's just like, they're just not really doing it. Right. But I give them kudos for the effort. If I had to pick one thing, like I would wish that Microsoft would commit to a transition to ARM, but that's not what they want to do. They seem to think that they're going to have they're going to support x86 and ARM forever off into the future, which I think is a dumb strategy, but that seems to be what they're doing, and that doesn't help me, and that doesn't help Windows games get ported to ARM. That all that does is bifurcate their market and say, well, all the AAA games will still be on x86 with NVIDIA cards, and ARM will just be for people's laptops, and Microsoft may be perfectly happy with that, but it doesn't help me over here with Apple Silicon.
I mean, what PC games are you playing with regularity right now?
I don't know if you know this, but Destiny runs on
right,
PC.
But that's the thing. Like, is there no other appliance that you can buy to run Destiny?
Destiny runs at higher resolution and higher frame rates on gaming PCs. I don't really play it on my Mac Pro. I play it on my PlayStation 5 for a variety of reasons. But it does run better, as defined by resolution and frame rate, even on my Mac Pro than on my PlayStation. Maxes out at 60 frames per second, right? And I can get higher than that. Depending on settings, and you can go way higher. You can go, I actually have played Destiny on my PS5 at 120 frames per second on my TV, but it has to lower the quality substantially, and I generally don't play Destiny on my TV because it'll burn it in, right? But I did try that just to see what it was like. 120 frames per second is good. All the, like, the Destiny streamers who are out there playing Destiny, they occasionally have their frame rate displayed in the corner. They're triple digits always, hundreds of frames per second, sometimes pushing them into 200. It makes a difference. It looks and feels smoother, especially in PvP. Like, that's, you know, and even if I'm playing like on a controller, because at this point, sadly, I'm better with a controller in Destiny than I am with mouse and keyboard. And also, controller's way better for my RSI, so I'd be doing it anyway. But yeah, Destiny is one choice. And games come out all the time, and they come out for PC. They don't come out for the Mac until 3 years later when Apple puts them in a keynote, right? So, you know, there's past games, there's future games, there's my gigantic Steam library that I still haven't played through. you know, I mean, I'll get a PlayStation 5 Pro. I'll get a PlayStation 6. I do like consoles. They're great. Maybe someday the gap between PC and console will be diminished. Even now, I would say it's more diminished because 60 frames per second on PS5 is such a change from 30 on the PS4 that I feel like the gap has narrowed, because Destiny players were playing at 100, you know, 200 frames per second back when I was playing 30. Now they're playing at 100, 200 frames per second, and I'm playing at 60. Right? I'm gaining on them. So maybe at some point I'll be like, you know what? I don't need a big GPU and I'll just get a Mac Studio and be happy with it. And that's looking like the most likely situation right now. But, you know, we'll see.
I mean, to be clear, as much as I'm giving you a hard time, I want you to have what you want. I can make an argument. Even I can make an argument for the Mac Pro, for a really beefy Mac Pro that's useful for people that work outside of a music studio. Like, I'm not saying that your desires or wants, as much as I'm giving you grief about it, I'm not saying your desires or wants are unreasonable. I don't think Apple will be achieving them. I don't think they're unreasonable.
It's exciting that they did with 2019, because again, I've said before, like, I don't, you know, despite my gaming things, this is not a purchase. This is not a rational purchase. In the same way that you don't need a Ferrari to get to work faster, people just like fast cars because they like fast cars.
Right.
And
that's allowed.
I just like powerful computers because I like powerful computers. It's exactly the same thing. Trying to justify a Mac Pro is like someone trying to justify a Ferrari. It's like, well, I need a car this fast to get to my work. No, you don't. Nobody does. Right. But right. People want them because they're cool.
Right. And that's fair. And that's totally fair. But I feel like to my eyes, we're starting to cross from, oh, it's kind of adorable that John is still rocking his Mac Pro, to like, man, I kind of want you to move on to a Mac Studio because I think you might enjoy it a lot more.
Well, I mean, I'm not buying an M2 one at this point.
Well, that's fair. No, that's
so
fair.
This is not the time to buy a Mac Studio. So.
It isn't. No. It isn't.
But I think
hanging
when
in
the
there
next,
for the M4 one.
Yeah, I think when the next one comes out, I think that's your move. I just cannot see a future in which they make the Mac Pro that you want. And so you might as well get
the
Mac Studio, which is the Mac Pro without slots. Like, that is the new Mac Pro. I can't say it enough.
And with a wimpier GPU.
But they just, like, the Mac Studio is the Mac Pro. They should have called it Mac Pro. That is the Apple Silicon.
Oh, can you imagine the aneurysm he would have had?
It doesn't make sense. They sell a thing called the Mac Pro that's way bigger.
But it's the same computer.
It's just a built-in PCI
breakout box.
Anyway, we'll see how it goes. And by the way, by the time I do get this, like, my computer is essentially 5 years old now. Already, this is a pretty good run for a computer that I bought at the, you know, just before the you know, processor transition, right? Which is, you know, unfortunate for the, we already said when it happened, like, oh, my poor Mac Pro or whatever. But I love this machine, and I've already gotten 5 years out of it, which granted is half of what I got out of my last Mac Pro, but, you know, processor transition, right? So if I ditch this machine at 6 years old, that's longer than any of your laptops lasted, right? it's still a pretty good run.
Hey, we're just excited if Marco makes it 6 months, much less 6 years.
Yeah, he's been pretty good with a 16-inch. I think it's almost 2 years old now, right?
No, it's the M3 Max. It's the black one that came out in the spring.
Oh, all right, never mind. Sorry.
I mean, to be honest, lately I haven't been much better, so I shouldn't be casting stones in this glass house. But generally speaking, Marco is much more frequent on his purchases.
So, I mean, like, no matter what, like, I feel like I've gotten a good run out of this Mac Pro, and I'm enjoying it for, you know, as long as, like, I'm excited that Sequoia runs on it. That's cool. Next year, probably not, right? So it's really putting a deadline on this. Like I said, I'm willing to run this with last year's version of the operating system for some period of time if I have to wait, right? But, you know, we'll see what happens. Like, I'm, you know, I keep my cars for a long time, I keep my Macs for a long time.
Gracious.
All right, titles.
Yes, I was waiting for you to tell everyone to bugger off, but I completely forgot about titles. All right.
Fake Drake.
I was waiting for somebody to suggest
Fake
that.
Fake Drake wasn't even from Udio and Suno or whatever. That was like an early voice thing. You know, yeah, really early AI voice thing.
Oh, there it is. I didn't see it.
But I'm sure Fake Drake songs are going to be part of the RIAA's, like, evidence, you know, collection of evidence. So, like, listen to these songs. Have you heard some of them, by the way? They're just like someone did, like, the Mariah Carey All I Want for Christmas thing. It just sounds so much like the actual song. Like, I feel like they're not going to do well in court with this.
I like a couple of things I suggested. Yeehaw, Cowboy Time. I like Technological Bank Vault. Polite Member of Web Society, I suggested, which I liked.
Kind of like This Animal Eats That Animal.
Yeah, it's fun.
We just found it on the doorstep.
The animal one is pretty good, actually.
I should get an AI model. When people ask me questions about it, I'm like, I don't know. I don't know anything about this. I have no idea where this came from. It's probably legal. Why are you asking me?
I'm sure.
Give me $5 a month so you can use it.
Everything's free out there. Don't worry about it.
It's freeware.
I'll charge you $5 a month to use this, but I have no idea where it came from. We didn't do this. It was like a subcontractor or something. I don't know. Anyway. Just like company after company. Like, what? Stop these people from speaking to the press. Have an answer. Have a little meeting beforehand and say, where do we train our model? Where did this come from? Does anybody know?
Nope, nobody does.
Oh, God.
So what do you guys like?
I like kind of like Cowboy Time without the yeehaw. Cowboy Time.
I like the one I suggested. It was annoyingly decent. I do like that, but I don't think you'll go for it. Because that was about the fish pre-show. That was a long time ago.
I like we just found it
on the doorstep. That is pretty good.
Yeah, we just found it on the doorstep. I like that one, too. What do you think,
Casey? I think I slightly prefer This Animal Eats That Animal, but I'm okay with the doorstep one for sure.
I like doorstep over animal, but I'd be fine with either one.
Yeah, I'll go with doorstep then.
All right, that works for me.
All right, thank you, live listeners. We're going to cut you off now to do overtime for the bootleg, and we have quite interesting recording schedule over the following weeks.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Our next recording is Monday the 8th, right? That's how I have it.
Mm-hmm. I believe that's right. It's off the top of my head. I think that's right.
Yeah. So next recording is Monday the 8th, and we will talk to you live people then. Bye.